Good morning. My name is Michael Fix, and I am proud to say that I am the president of the Migration Policy Institute, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you all to this, the 13th annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference. We at the Migration Policy Institute are absolutely delighted to have had such a long and productive relationship and partnership with Georgetown Law Center and with the Catholic Immigration Network in putting on this important annual conference. And with immigration at the epicenter of the political debate, certainly at the epicenter of all of our lives, I feel almost entirely confident that you're going to enjoy today's lineup of both speakers and topics. We're going to range widely from the politics that drive the discussion to some of the most important legal and policy developments over this tumultuous year, to the future landscape for action with a new Congress and with a new president. I'm particularly delighted to welcome this year's keynote speakers, Deputy Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas of the Department of Homeland Security, a good friend to so many of us and certainly to us at the Migration Policy Institute. And I'm also absolutely delighted to welcome U.S. Senator Richard Durbin. We're going to learn much from them, as well as our other just excellent speakers. I want to thank Georgetown Law for their hospitality in hosting this conference every year, although it sometimes gives me the willies to come here because this is where I took the bar exam. And I want to recognize the Dean of the Law School, William Traynor, as well as another longtime friend at Georgetown, Professor Andy Schoenholtz, who's worked relentlessly and tirelessly with us on this conference through the years, along with his colleagues and their colleagues in the media and events departments. We're grateful to Gene Atkinson, the executive director of Clinic, who isn't able to join us today, unfortunately, and her former colleague, Charles Wheeler, who is here, as well as the terrific staff from Clinic. At MPI, I must recognize my colleagues, Doris Meisner and Muzaffar Chishti, who lead our efforts in pulling this event together. But they've done this with the absolute necessary support and brilliant support of our Director of Events, Lisa Dixon, and our Director of Communications, Michelle Mittelstadt, and the communications staff at MPI. And finally, I'd like to thank you all for coming. Even at this early hour, I can see many familiar faces in the audience and know that many of you travel some distance to come here every year. We appreciate your attendance, your involvement, your smart and thoughtful, and even your uncomfortable questions throughout the day. And so with that, I want to turn the program over to my colleague, Doris Meisner. Doris is a senior fellow at MPI. She directs our U.S. Immigration Policy Program and is, as many of you know, the distinguished former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. So with that, Doris.
Well, good morning. I am so pleased to be able to begin this day today by welcoming and introducing Alejandro Mayorkas, Ali Mayorkas. Ali, of course, is familiar to most everybody in this room and known personally by many of the people in this room. And that's because he's always gone the extra mile in forging relationships and, very importantly, in listening. We first met in 2009 when he reached out to me, having just come to town. He was to be taking over USCIS. It had not yet happened. And we had an incredibly productive first conversation, which grew into a very productive relationship over all of these years since. And, of course, after having served for several years at USCIS as the director, he graduated, he was promoted through a rather difficult process, but nonetheless promoted to becoming the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. where he has been since administering a $60 billion budget with 240,000 staff. Let's think about that. But I think it's fair to say that even with that sprawling mission and the incredible range of responsibilities that the Department of Homeland Security has and is responsible for, he's probably spent the bulk of his time of any one issue on immigration issues. So he has, for the span of this administration, almost uniquely been in places where policy making and policy execution meet. And that is an extraordinary vantage point. So we wanted to, at this point, when the Obama years are coming to an end, to provide an opportunity for him to reflect on that perspective and to tell us about this, the record of this very activist administration during a very demanding time. So this is really an opportunity to, as I said in inviting him, write the first draft of the history of this era. We're very interested to hear it. We're very interested and pleased to have you with us, Ali. Please come to the podium.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to share some thoughts with you. I should comment on very briefly on my relationship with Doris Meissner. Thank you very much for the too kind introduction. Doris is more than a mentor and an advisor to me. It's a little bit more unique than that. She's actually my role model in terms of what it means to be a fair, a just, and a dignified government servant. And so my friendship with Doris is extraordinarily important, not only to my life, but to my work. I'm a political refugee. I was born in Cuba, and my parents brought my sister and me to this country to flee the communist takeover of Cuba. My parents did not want to raise their children in a communist regime. And my identity as a political refugee was extraordinarily important to my upbringing, and my parents were very focused on instilling in me a deep sense of what it means and what it meant to be a refugee, to be an individual displaced from one's home and the country in which one's parents dreamed of raising their children. In 2010 and 11, I had, in the course of my work as the director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the opportunity to learn a great deal about our administration of the refugee system and to learn about refugees displaced all over the world. And there was one experience in particular that, quite frankly, shook my identity as a political refugee. I went with colleagues to Nairobi to view our refugee operation there. And from Nairobi, we took a small plane to the Kenyan-Somali border and visited the refugee camp of Dadaab. At the time, back then, just about 6 years ago, Dadaab had originally been developed for the placement of about 90,000 Somali refugees on their way to resettlement in third countries. In 2010, when I visited, there were just over 300,000 people. And I would describe them as poor, except for the fact that poverty suggests that individuals have something, but just not enough to make it through. and these individuals had absolutely nothing. I had never seen anything like it. They lived, they dwelled, they slept on the sand, and some of them had plastic bags hoisted on sticks as their only cover, and the others who didn't have those plastic bags had nothing. And I remember sitting in on an interview of a refugee family conducted by one of our refugee affairs officers. And the family consisted of a husband and wife, a father and a mother, and their four children, and a very close-knit family. And the eldest of the children was a young 17-year-old woman. And our refugee affairs officer asked her where she had been born. And I thought she was going to say Somalia. And by the way, around the camp, for as far as the eye could see, there is sand and there is heat. There is really nothing. And it was inconceivable to me how these individuals could even arrive at Dadaab safely. And of course, many, many did not. The 17-year-old woman, in response to the question where she was born, answered, "Here. I was born here." And she had lived her entire life, 17 years, in this camp where poverty would actually be an exaggeration. And I came back from that trip, and I had a very difficult time identifying myself as a refugee, political or otherwise, understanding the depth of despair and loss that others who seek the benefits of our refugee system have suffered. And I won't, Doris, I won't seek to draft the first iteration of a look back at the Obama administration, but I just want to share a thought on the notion of identity, because it is identity that has to serve as the foundation of our approach to the difficult immigration issues we confront. We have to give thought to the fundamental and foundational question of who we are as a country and who we should be. And how we answer that question on the subject of immigration should be our guidepost in traveling through and managing the very, very difficult and sensitive and too often divisive challenges that we face. And so let me give an example or two. The Syrian refugee crisis. There were and remain at least two different approaches priorities that are in tension with one another, and people come down on different sides of that tension. On the one hand, there are many who believe that it is one of our proudest traditions as a country to be a place of refuge for those in greatest need, and certainly the individuals fleeing the horror that too often occurs in Syria qualify in that category. And there is a strong sentiment among many that we need to open our arms more widely and more receptively and embrace more strongly a greater number of refugees than we have historically. And historically, of course, we have been the leader in the world in resettling refugees. That leadership, numerically, we can no longer claim, given the fact that we're speaking of over 4 million individuals displaced from the Middle East in this time of great turbulence and terrorism. On the other hand, there are individuals who believe that the Syrian refugees as a population bring a component of a concern for our security that a component of that population may very well present a threat to our security, that the vetting of these individuals is especially challenging because we don't have the wealth of background information about them, and we must be therefore much more circumspect than the President has expressed as our intention as an administration. And how one answers that tension and the challenge of those competing considerations, in my opinion, should be answered by how one defines who we are as a country, who we should be, and who we want to be, not only today, but also tomorrow. And so I don't necessarily suggest what my view of the answer is, but I just think that we must reflect on our identity and what it needs to be as we seek to answer that question. On the issue of security, by the way, one of the things that has developed in my thinking over the last 7 years is to, frankly, add an additional pillar to the three foundational pillars of our immigration system. The three traditional ones are, of course, humanitarian relief, family unity, and economic prosperity. And I do think that the notion of security, the security of our country, needs to be explicitly articulated as a fourth pillar, given the realities of the world in which we find ourselves. I have found that the community, and that is, of course, not a monolithic entity, but the community presents us with our greatest challenge. The community, individuals and advocates and thought leaders challenge us in the administration most aggressively when the community believes, and whatever the community's views or diversity of views are, when the community believes that we are actually acting inconsistent with our identity of who we are and who we should be as a country. I think the rhetoric becomes strongest and the indignation becomes most acute when people perceive a gap between our behavior and our character and our identity. The issue of migration from the Northern Triangle, from the Central American countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Many have taken great issue with the administration's removal of individuals who have not qualified for refugee status or asylum status in the United States, and our practice of removing those who have not qualified for relief under our law. The criticism has been that we should be more expansive in how we welcome individuals who, I think, without controversy, everyone understands, are fleeing despair, great violence, great socioeconomic challenge, and great challenges in their lives. We are a nation of immigrants, and we are a nation of laws. Whether we expand the bases on which we seek to welcome these individuals fleeing a better life is a question that is answered by thinking of who we want to be as a country. Understanding that we have to manage our borders, are we proudest when we manage those most effectively, and hew with some orthodoxy to the standards articulated in the law, or are we most noble when we exercise our discretion with greater generosity and welcome these individuals? I don't mean to suggest an answer, but I pose to you the questions that bear on the issue of what one thinks our identity is and should be, and therefore the answer to that tension and those somewhat divergent questions, or at least the answers diverge from those questions. How does one resolve it? I, of course, have my views, Some might describe me as an opinionated individual. I would hope so. I have an opinion on just about every single issue under the sun. That's not to say that I'm unwilling to change my opinion, but I hope that people who are interested in the issues of our day and the challenges of our times have views and strong views about how best to resolve them. Recently, the Department of Justice announced that it would be moving its contracted penal institutions to government-run institutions. The Department of Justice primarily runs through the Bureau of Prisons the majority of its institutions already, but some are contracted out. Immigration and Customs Enforcement relies a great deal, much more so than does the Department of Justice, on contracted facilities. And the question has arisen in the public discourse whether Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a component agency of our Department of Homeland Security, should follow suit and should end the contracted facilities, and we in the federal system should run them ourselves. I think actually one editorial writer captured what I think is a more fundamental question, of identity, which is the question of, are we detaining the right people? And are we proud of the conditions in which we house them during the period of their detention? Straying a little bit from the question of the day of who's operating the facility to the more integral question of who is in the facility and what are the conditions of their confinement. Those two questions, I don't articulate a guiding thought in terms of my opinion, but those two questions to me go more fulsomely to the issue of our identity, and that how we answer that identity should be the guidepost of how we resolve that. I will, because I can't help but opine on this last example, and that is children in the immigration system. Having prosecuted criminal cases, having observed removal proceedings, having seen firsthand the meaning of a removal proceeding on the life of an individual, when removal has been eminently deserved, and clearly compelled by the law, it's a very consequential event in an individual's life, and it should be therefore a consequential event in the life of our country. And I have seen very young children in removal proceedings without guidance or without representation of counsel. And I hearken back to the Supreme Court decision of Plyler versus Doe, which gave all children, regardless of their the lawfulness of their presence in the United States, a right to an education. And I profoundly believe that every Doe has a name, is a person, and is entitled to a future, wherever that future might be. And it is hard for me, as a former federal prosecutor, as a lawyer who has maintained his bar status active, and who views himself as an officer of the court, to think of a very young child in a removal proceeding not understanding the meaning, the procedures, and the consequence of what is about to happen. As I look back for a brief second on the last 7 years, One of the signature achievements of this administration is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA, that impacted the children as well. Children who were brought here by no intention of their own, but by the acts of others. And I think how we treat their presence here as they reach the age of maturity throughout the years is a question of our identity as a nation and how we view our immigration system. It is, in fact, the twilight of the Obama administration. I think that very significant immigration issues will confront the new administration, and I do hope that the new administration confronts the very challenging and consequential immigration issues that will be before it. Most notably, of course, the incontrovertible fact that our immigration system is broken, needs to be fixed, and what should that fix look like, and hopefully may it be implemented. And as we look at that issue, I hope we think of our identity, who we are as a nation, and who we want to be, and how we answer and respond to that issue hopefully will be a reflection of how we answer the question of our identity. And on that, I will end with just a very brief quote of Robert Kennedy. Our attitude towards immigration reflects our faith in the American ideal. And I hope we live up to that. Thank you very much.
Oh, sure. Well, Ali, thank you so very much. We have maybe 10 minutes for Q&A, which is going to take place from the microphones that are in the aisle. So please feel free, either in this aisle or in this aisle, to come to the microphone if you have a question. And now, folks.
This is frankly too good to be true.
Right. This tends not to happen.
Really?
It's early.
I guess so. I'm awake. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for those very thoughtful remarks as you're looking back. And I'm really glad you've raised those questions. I'm going to just ask you about one of those areas, because it's one that's troubled me a great deal during this administration. And that has to do with the reaction to the arrival of larger numbers of Central Americans from the Northern Triangle, particularly women and children, than we've had in a number of years. And the question on my mind, when I think of a refugee, a humanitarian emergency or a crisis or something like that, as you've seen in different parts of the world, I think that the best tool the government has to address that is temporary protection. It's not to throw people into quick asylum procedures or anything else that really results in our government getting overwhelmed, whether it's our asylum officers that you're in charge of or the immigration judges that the Justice Department is in charge of. Both the humanitarian reaction, the leadership needed in this administration was to use temporary protected status as a way to receive people. And then, in time, if the crisis continued and people could want to apply for asylum, they could do that. But in the meantime, we wouldn't be removing people to situations where the government itself, DHS, has said now publicly in Federal Register notices that the violence is significant in these particular countries. And therefore, we've continued to protect those with TPS from Salvador and Honduras who've been here since 99 and 2001. So, long-winded question, but I'd really like to hear your comments on that approach. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So this has been a very, very difficult issue, and let me speak to some of the things that we have done and respond quite squarely to the issue of temporary protected status, which I know has been the subject of a great deal of advocacy. Quite a number of organizations through Clinic, I believe, an extraordinarily wonderful institution that I have gotten to know over the course of the last 7 years, I think submitted a letter, if I'm not mistaken, to the president very recently. And as I understand it, temporary protected status protects those individuals already in the United States as of a certain date. And the question will be, what does that mean with respect to the continuous flow of individuals from these countries? Because the conditions in these countries continue to be very challenging. And so I don't know, and when I say that, I mean that, whether temporary protected status is actually the right solution to the problem. And so that, I think, is under study. But the administration has done some very, very important things that were announced within the last 2 months. Early on, we developed a Central American Minors Program that allowed minors to be brought here without having to take the perilous journey, because the determination was made there in the Central American countries that they could qualify for humanitarian relief. They could qualify as refugees, or alternatively, that given the compelling equities that their case presented, extraordinary humanitarian relief should be extended and they could be paroled into the United States. Importantly, we've worked with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees to actually build the first in many, many years of a formal refugee program, also obviating the need for people in despair from taking the perilous journey from those countries through Mexico, trying to reach the southern border of the United States. And now we'll have the UN High Commissioner for Refugees administering a formal refugee program in those countries, in country, which is an unusual paradigm for UNHCR, but an extraordinary move in light of the problems and challenges there. And also, Costa Rica has agreed to serve as an emergency safety zone for those individuals who cannot even wait for UNHCR to respond in country. And so I think over the course of the last year, the humanitarian programs have expanded significantly. I think the expansion will be even greater in the coming months, and we have under study the solution that you present, that others have proposed and support, and we'll see what comes of that. The solution, the ultimate solution, of course, the ultimate solution is to address the fundamental push factors to enable these countries to actually beat down the sources of violence so that children are safe walking to school, to address the socioeconomic disenfranchisement, the root causes of this migration.
Should we take one more?
Oh, no, okay. We can take a few.
Over here.
So obviously in the field of immigration, every issue is pressing. There are so many people with such great need. But are there, like, what issues do you see that haven't arisen yet but are going to? You know, what are the up-and-coming issues? What is the future of immigration policy? Things that aren't being addressed now, like things, problems that have not yet arisen but you can foresee. I don't know.
Yeah. So Nostradamus I am not. That I would have to really give thought to. What, in other words, what's around the corner? What's around the corner?
I
look, what's around the corner is what has come around the corner a lot. So I would say, you know, it's around the block over again, which is comprehensive immigration reform, and what are we going to do? I will tell you this, too. When I was a federal prosecutor, for 12 years, I would look at the statutory framework in which we operated as criminal prosecutors, and I would say, this makes sense. It's a dynamic, it's not without tension, but it's a rather orderly set, an orderly statutory framework that is driven to the three goals of criminal justice: punishment, deterrence, and rehabilitation. I look at the immigration statutory framework, and I find it to completely lack cohesion, that sometimes some provisions have been drafted at one time in our country's history, and we go left, and another provision is drafted at another time in our country, and we go right. I don't mean that left and right politically. I mean just in direction of our identity, and the two coexist and are not reconciled. And so, for example, an individual who is eligible for removal may also be eligible for naturalization, and sometimes the individual is removed and sometimes the individual is naturalized, and I don't understand. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, we'll do a final, because we need to let the deputy, Ali, go, but let's take this final question.
Good morning. My question has to do with the requirement that Congress has placed on your department year after year to maintain 34,000 beds for immigrant detention per night. And my question, first question is, do you feel like that is a fiscally responsible policy? Second, more important question is, do you think it allows your department the flexibility to address the question that you raised earlier of who, if anyone, we should be detaining, and ensure that we're not causing undue suffering from the family separation and community disruption that immigrant detention inevitably causes?
So let me answer that, if I may, how precisely the Secretary has answered it in response to the congressional inquiry, which is that that there's not a statutory, in the Secretary's interpretation, there is not a statutory mandate that we keep 34,000 people in custody at all times, but rather that we are funded with 34,000 beds, and therefore we're funded with the capacity to have 34,000 individuals in detention at a particular time. Things are in tension. Many have expressed profound concern with the detention of families, with the detention of children. Those in enforcement have expressed profound concern that in the process of removal, there's a very significant failure to appear rate, that individuals do not appear for their hearings, and therefore removal orders are issued in absentia, that people do not, that are fugitives from the removal court. And so where one comes out on that, one has to give due consideration to all of the factors and answer it fundamentally with what you think is most important. One more question, maybe.
I think we need to let you go.
Okay. Sorry.
I've been told. So, Ali,
thank
terrific.
You. Thank you all very much.